Love breathes underwater, like sea creatures. Slow in how it teaches, gliding and grazing like a graceful ray. An opening anemone, raising tendrils in time to the pulse of the sea, and drawing them in again. Its only enemy, that toothy little fish of irony. For years it followed me, nipping my Achilles from behind, to remind me of times I was blind to love that never left. When buried, bereft, my heart burrowed low, so no one else could bruise it, didn't know that hiding was the only way to lose it. Since the Ice Age, she's been down in the basement, digging through boxes, trying to find something she thought she had lost. The original skin of shape-shifting foxes, the thing she swore not to lose at any cost. She'd come to believe she was not a real person, maybe a creature someone put a curse on, assuming human form, to learn a lesson while she's here. A shapeshifter, a drifter, more at home, roaming open fields alone, than tethered to another and living undercover in a room no matter how warm. She'd come to miss the furred perk of her alert ears, the magic broomstick of her tail, her padded paws turning circles thrice before she sleeps. But whatever original skin she was born with is hidden away somewhere in a box. So no human lover would ever discover she's not actually a girl, but a fox. One who walks and talks like a regular girl, but if she falls in love, it's the end of the world for her, the permanent transfer from one life form to another. If love ever uncovered her original skin, she might never fit back into it again, slip into it and slink out the door. She might never be the same as she was before. Then she met you, and she wasn't afraid. Though you didn't feel like a choice she had made at first, more like a kind of emulsion or expulsion from the secret garden of her discontent. You must have been heaven sent. She prayed for answers from the sky, but looked to earth for her reply, the nodding god of yes, who was so welcome in your eye. Your heart beat a happy tattoo when she opened the door, and yes, it was true, nothing was the same as it had been before you. Like shiny scales of goldfish, you opened eyes on her skin, and they wept out oceans lying within. Old loves flood away to make room for a new one. Didn't think she had it left in her to even pursue one, and recent questions as to whether she was even human. Letters that she didn't send, love she swore would never end, apology calls she didn't make, loves lost or tossed by blind mistake, and all the roads she didn't take. Love is the one who's hard to find. Love is the one who knows your mind. Love is the one who feeds your soul. Love's the one to have and hold. But hold a minute, hold how? There's 100 hungry ways to hold her up or hold her down. Will she still be able to get around? Will she be able to hold her ground? So she digs down deep to the bottom of the box to find the original hide of the fox, and it's there all right, despite paranoia, some lover would thieve it, slip it on and slink away. The choice was always hers to retrieve it. But who wears furs these days? Perhaps her fears had fallen out of fashion. Perhaps there were more human ways of nourishing a passion. But look, beneath the fox at the bottom of the box, a book about biology. And being a student of life, she took hold of it in her own hands. She let it unfold in hopes it would offer a lesson to teach. It fell open to the name Halocynthia oranthium, or in more common terms, the sea peach. The sea peach is a creature who looks like a heart living at the bottom of the ocean, rooted in place by a sucker on its underpart, grounded, holding steady as devotion. Its evolution has chosen this sort of lifestyle. Halocynthia oranthium, in luminous hues of a peach chrysanthemum by sublime chance or divine artistry, with two branching siphons raised overhead, like the aorta and the pulmonary artery, one to take things in, one to give things out. The sea peach teaches what the heart is about. Through its two siphons, the sea peach feeds, breeds, and breathes, taking in food and oxygen, inspiration, exhaling tiny tadpoles to the tide, to reroute themselves elsewhere in some other place. All this from a creature who has no face. No crises of identity, the ability to simply be. No mind, but no matter, none of the clatter and chatter of the human brain. No broken-hearted sea peach ever drove itself insane, and its offers of asylum have no locks on either side. So she chose the book of life and closed the box on the fox hide. Phylum Chordata. The sea peach is a chordate, just like me. The marine iguana, the great horned toad, and the chimpanzee. Which means we all have spinal structures, just like you. The giant squid, the gerbil, and the caribou. Each who shares the chordate name starts out looking pretty much the same, at least in our prenatal form. Then we start to shift our shapes after we're born. From guinea hens to wide-mouthed bass, we all begin as tadpoles, with something like a head and something like a tail. Headstrong and wriggling, just like the rest of us. Prairie chickens, Gila monsters, Arctic perch, and hippopotamus. Cheetahs, horses, salamanders, goats, and stoats, and geese, and ganders, and the sea peach, too, to name but a few. We all start out with heads and tails, but it's here in evolution the sea peach derails. It doesn't grow a spine, and it doesn't grow a face. It only grows a sucker to ground itself in place. Like a heart who hears the murmur of its purpose here on Earth, it finds a spot of ocean floor and settles toward rebirth. She studies the sea peach a very long time, until it seemed she'd almost become one. Not in the sense of losing her spine, but the sense of trusting in someone. First comes a voice, then comes a choice. Maybe it comes from within and it ripples without, and quietly it tells you what your life is about in murmured whispers thumping somewhere in your chest. Or it comes from without and touches within and opens up a million tiny eyes on your skin, and you can see clearly now.
You can see clearly now. Those were the last words spoken by Cat Kid from a track called Sea Peach. You're listening to Sonic Lit, a spoken web radio show. My name is Catherine McLeod, and I'm here live in the studio with...
Jason Camelot. I'm here with Catherine McLeod in the studio. We haven't been here for a little while, so it's nice to be back.
Yeah, we're back after attending a poetry performance conference in Vienna, of all places. So you're going to hear a little bit about that today. I'm also just adjusting my microphone while talking because it sounds a little funny to me, but does it sound all right to you, Jason?
It sounds funny, but in a good way.
Yeah, yeah, at least I think the way that it's the broadcasting is okay. It's a little fuzzy in our ears, but we're going to trust that it's making it clearly out onto the airwaves. So we were in Vienna at a poetry conference, which was called Poetry Off the Page Around the Globe. And we got to hear a lot of academic talks about poetry performance, which was really fascinating because it was interesting to see how scholars in Europe were approaching poetry performance and really to hear the range of examples that that people were working with and different kinds of either approaches to, you know, archives of poetry recordings or festivals, or thinking about really the ways in which one goes about studying poetry performance. And we also got to hear some performances by European poets, plus Canadian poet Claire Duplessis, who was there at the conference as well, from the Spoken Web contingent, who was presenting. And so, yeah, we're back and really feeling inspired about poetry performance, which did inspire our choice for today. But before we tell you about our choice for today, Jason, any, you know, thoughts about poetry performance from Vienna that just have stayed with you and you'd like to share with our listeners?
Well, it was a conference called Poetry Off the Page, appropriately, and it was really eye-opening and ear-opening in the sense that we got to hear poets who really focus on sort of live performance from many different countries. So I really learned a lot about, say, poetry and slam in India, for example. There were a lot of German poets, poets from other Nordic countries, as well as England and Australia and New Zealand. Mm-hmm. So it was a very international conference. And as we were thinking, you know, coming back, what are we going to do our first show on? We were initially thinking, yeah, maybe we'll do a show specifically on the Vienna conference. And we are going to do that because we interviewed a bunch of the performers who were there. Mm-hmm. But before that show, it got me thinking, we have such amazing spoken word and performance artists here in Montreal. And really, Cat Kid came to mind as one of the performers who, first of all, has performed on international stages all over the place and probably is known to some of the performers that we heard, but also whose art and talents really stand up within that sort of international roster that we witnessed.
Mm-hmm. And when Jason suggested Cat Kid, I thought it was so perfect for those reasons, and also because the conference in some ways reminded me of a conference I attended back in 2008 in Saskatoon, of all the places, not so international, but in Saskatoon, there was a conference that was based around performance poetry, and Cat Kid was there, and that's actually where I first heard her perform in 2008. And at that conference, Paul Dutton, who alas recently passed away, but Paul Dutton was there, performed. Adina Karasek was there. Bill Bissett was there. It was really like quite a list of poetry performers from Canada. So, you know, when Jason suggested Cat Kid, I was like, oh, I felt like I was right in that zone of thinking back to that experience. Plus, Cat Kid has just come out with a new album, and I was also thinking of her because I'd arrived back pretty much the night that she was launching that album as part of the Suoni per Popolo Festival here in Montreal at Sala Rosa, and it looked like a really terrific show, but alas, I could not attend, so I was glad to get to have a listen to her new album, Rock Dove, in preparation for this show.
Yeah, so we are going to listen to a good portion of Rock Dove today, but we started with a track from an earlier record that Kat put out called Sea Peach, mm-hmm. and the piece we listened to is the title track, Sea Peach, with soundscapes by Jackie Murda in this case. Cat Kid's been really was a staple on the Montreal spoken word scene, you know, from the 90s on, and often very early on worked with musicians, very talented musicians who were using sampling and creating these really amazing soundscapes to accompany the worlds that she creates in her work. She is a poet slash storyteller. And also, I mean, it's really interesting, and we'll spend some time later. I want to get to listening again, but we'll spend some time today thinking a little bit about what form does Cat Kid work in, because I think she really pushes the boundaries on generic forms, you know, on genres. Mm-hmm. She's written a novel. She works, obviously, in performance, but she also has published books, and very often, and early on, was putting out sort of books / CDs, you know, mm-hmm. books that came with CDs or books that came with CD-ROMs that documented some of the performance. So another sort of contribution through her career that Cat Kid has made is sort of really thinking about the various media formats that can be used to try to communicate an art form that is intermedial. You know, it really isn't just sort of graspable in one particular form or format.
Yeah, and on this show, Sonic Lit, we've been listening to new albums by Montreal-based poets, like the album by Fire, also Tanya Evanson's new album. And so this, you know, seemed really apt to listen to Cat Kid's new album. But yes, as Jason said, we listened to a classic of hers, Sea Peach. And I feel like actually Sea Peach is like one of those hits that, like, when I've seen her perform, it's like, oh yes, she's going to perform Sea Peach. And it's just really, yeah, it's beautiful to hear.
I have very fond memories of seeing a live performance of Sea Peach. It was at the theater that's in a swimming pool.
Ben Saint-Mathieu, I think.
Yeah, I think so. And actually, in honor of seeing that performance and my excitement going to it, I brought a little flask of peach schnapps with me. And so while I was watching Sea Peach at the time, I was sipping peach schnapps. And it was an incredible performance. We'll talk more about Cat Kid, what those performances look like, and how her voice is so often complemented by her great talents and movement and gesture. But should we just get into listening to a bit of the new album?
Yeah, should we, I don't know, should we take a pause for ID and ad before we head into the album? Or what do you think, Jason?
Yeah, let's do that and then now. We'll just go straight some tracks from Rock Dove after that.
Excellent. That? Stay tuned.
On July 11th, come on out to FM Fest, a community-led festival focused on emerging local talent and a celebration of the music scene here in Montreal. Across Casa do Popolo, La Sauterania, and La Sala Rosa, it will be a full night of music featuring Ryan Brio, Parallel, MOC, Divance, Fails, Worth Creating, Nuji. The show continues in January, Chong, Horizons, Honey, and Resonance. Tickets are just $15 plus fees too. For more information, follow the Fluid Mosaic on Instagram. This event is backed and sponsored by CGLO 1690 AM, Infamy, Non-Binary Twins, et Les Insoumises.
A woman wears a murmuration underneath her clothes. Storms of starlings scoring chord lines where her blood veins flow. And covens of rock doves carrying love notes, bearing her heart back home. And larks still bravely singing fly.
We thought of her then as an exiled queen from legends back when we were allies. Or a sorceress casting meticulous spells aloud. We knew she spent most of her time alone, consumed by complicated rituals of great significance to someone. First person singular doesn't exist in our language, being too hypothetical to be useful. Yet she calls your humble servant her special little one, sings songs with this given name more times than is seemly, sings she'll always take care of Happy. She promises this. For a time, it was the only name she spoke who knew her heart. Had she always been kept here like this, in this prison fortress, or hadn't there been a time before when she played a different role? For how many incarnations had she been tethered to a pole and set on fire by close foes or secret admirers? Our own people had once been more loved than we find ourselves today. We know how it changes the way a body behaves in public, needing to know if those who approach are friends or no. There could be high drama behind any pair of eyes. Any Pyrrhic footing may carry the bearer from peril just prior to our interception. Maybe missing a mate, youngsters taken by predators, returning to places of safety to find them decimated, horrors of thirst or starvation brought by dwindling environment. These concerns consume our every day, and we share every one of them with humans. One might have expected this to matter more to a greater number of your great species, though we're grateful for all who do recall how we share this planetary home together, as well as a unique history. But your voices are still too scarce heard above thinning industry. Only a lunatic few take time to speak with us. There's a Spanish proverb: let there be no lack of food in the pigeon house, and the pigeons will come. It means, well, it's pretty literal, really, as proverbs go. It couldn't be stated more plainly. Feed pigeons in houses that you build for us. This wouldn't be charity. Have we no right to point out what might be owed to us? Why not resurrect dovecotes on spots now occupied by monuments to colonial tossers who ought to be ousted? A sound initiative. Even an employment opportunity for any of those scattered souls who do love Rock Dove company, leaving neither undesirable party to clutter your streets. Unless what's known of collective recollection in the common pigeon is peristeronic solipsism, any one of our vast number possesses a more or less total recall of the last few million years, when, as we recall more or less totally, there occurred great increase in evolutionary diversification, giving rise to the some 10,000 bird species who have come into existence since the fall of mighty Archaeopteryx, praise and thanks, from whom we all blessedly descend. But here comes the sound of someone breathing in short pants. Most likely, Our Lady. Home at last. She takes off her hat, hangs it on a hook, unbuttons her coat, clears her throat, billows air up and down her damp T-shirt. She smells of urban rain, sour milk, tea biscuits, and dirt. Reaching up under there, she feels along her collarbones and finds a pull tab at center, tugs it downward. She unzips her sternum, and out pour birds. Rock doves, dozens and dozens and cousins and covens of them. The dull thud of a thousand gray wings adjusting airborne, scraping talons like crimson beads, breaking free of a choker and scattering everywhere, never to be gathered back up again. Not a single bird can be unborn. And this is no metaphor. Door jams, window ledges, bookshelves, and floors are literally littered with pigeons. Billing, cooing, flapping, crapping, strutting, fretting, rutting, cresting, molting, nesting, dusty, musky, millet, peckin' pigeons. They became her best, then only friends. Just how this had come to pass, much depends on whom you ask. At worst, no fewer than 30 birds were raising broods atop storage bins, plastering Jackson Pollock's blotches across tabletops to a Hitchcockian foley of flutters, flaps, and coos, erratic tap-tap-tapping of bony little toes, step-step-stepping over linoleum. Rock doves could observe you from above while you were in the tub or in the loo. Rock doves may be napping in your hat or in your shoes. Feel free to judge. That's partly the point of this poem. So here we find her, crouched in the corner it had taken over a decade to paint herself into with nowhere to jump. There'd been a slow severance of relations between thought and sentiment, such that she'd begun to sink, slow as sediment, deep into the abyssal zone, own, own. Her heart became a brittle crab, could only scuttle out and grab, then scurry home to picket exoskeletons in darkness, moving mouth parts. Scarce able to feel her own heart stir, likewise had it little care left for her. It crept away beneath her bed, she seldom wondered where it went, then one night heard a muffled crick beneath her boot, like breaking a tiny Christmas light. There'd be few reasons to revisit such dark days if not for art's sake, and with a flashlight, so that even one other creature might see her own shadow down there and feel a bit less all wrong, a bit more all right. Nine out of ten voices in my head don't want to hear another peep out of me. That tenth dissenting voice has little other choice but to keep on, keep on peeping. There'd been no diagnosis for almost half a century, by which point in time it was hardly a surprise to me. I had just become too tired trying to hide this murmuration churning inside my mind, these widening gyres under pressure of bone confined, and I'm no longer a tenable tenant of my own cranium. So I'm treading trepidatiously, or facing trepidation, just paces away from the epicenter of this exploding aviary in my brain. Oh no, its pan runneth over again, due to that same fatal wobble in the mechanism. Like every endeavor ever tried, finds its wings at first all right, until near the 11th hour with end in sight, when it suddenly veers off left, never right, or blam, gets shot down from the sky. Like some karmic snipers had my bird in sight the entire time since its genesis, just to hasten its exodus, then straight to revelations on how my goals go to hell on a regular Monday to Friday basis. But gratefully, there's a name for this. Plate tectonics. And once more your hopes explode in blood red pinwheels in the sky. You're tumbling down the stairs, dropping each and every pie. You're sliding down the snake's back to square one again. Why? Long snake.
Short ladders.
Long snakes.
Short ladders.
Long snakes.
Short ladders.
Long snakes.
Short little ladders.
Was it three or four, or more like four or five entire careers sent careening wildly off course before sliding headlong into a ditch? Security tapes indicating there wasn't even a driver at the wheel at the time. No responsible adult of sound body and mind capable of grasping even placidly the consequences of her own actions. There have been no such person present at certain critical junctures, except for, you know who.
Coo. Coo.
Yes, it must have been a pigeon who was driving the bus, or else our lady would most likely be no longer with us. Ask her yourself, not a word of a lie. Last night a pigeon saved my life. She'd been repeatedly warned to stop taking care of us, but we knew she'd never turn us away. It was almost like back in the old days, when pigeon and human were perched side by side in spirit of camaraderie and clear communication between species. You lauded our qualities of loyalty, courage, and endurance. They would be of great assistance, you told us. For soon there'd be essential messages needing to be sent, requiring our living, striving blood and strenuous involvement for a greater good than any of our solitary selves, you told us. We did not precisely say yes. And yet today we're pests who've been your friends for millennia, even held in highest sanctity as back in the 13th century above the blessed head of the Black Madonna of Montserrat in Catalonia is suspended a resplendent pigeon. Crafted all in sterling with outstretched wings, the protector, of a divine mother. But our entanglement with human beings reaches even further back than monotheism. Mesopotamian cuneiform tablets from 5,000 years ago describe our alliance. Difficult to pinpoint an exact place of origin, somewhere in the convergence of Europe, Asia, and North Africa. but we were roughly domesticated by humans. Domesticated by humans roughly 10,000 years ago, then followed your expansion all over the globe. You've been bloody everywhere, bloodied everywhere. Today, you will find us rock doves on every continent except Antarctica. Your species may be taught from a very young age that we're more parasites than persons. The real question being how to exterminate us in ways which won't arouse public sentiment around our defense, such as on one previous attempt when poison seeds took several excruciating days to kill us. Only then was this practice judged inhumane, even for such ones as we'd so abruptly found ourselves to be. Human beings are capable of extraordinary evil. Though this no longer shocks us, it does not lose its power to surprise. Surely, a species as superlative as yours must possess power to change yourselves, and not just everything else. A woman wears a murmuration underneath her hair. Crowds of starlings scouring lifelines where her dendrites flare. When I was 8 years old, we moved from Whitehorse to East Van. There was this pigeon in the gym at my new school who had nowhere to land. We were all sitting cross-legged on the gymnasium floor for what was called an assembly. At 8 already, I hated the concept. Humans in groups could be very stupid, like now, with all the kids pointing and shouting at this poor bird who was just trying to find some way out of there, but the noisy crowd was making that pretty much impossible. There must have been at least one other kid at that assembly who knew what they were doing was only making things worse for the bird. A kid who likewise identified with the pigeon and knew all it needed was a safe place to land, just so you can catch your breath. Some folks could try just a little bit harder. With those views you hold on pigeons, eccentrics, and other social outsiders that you wear on your face and body language, because they do tend to give you away the moment it appears to dawn on you that the individual you're speaking to lives with some kind of odd-mindedness. There's a split second between your brows, a micro-expression, and uh-oh. Tables are turned against me again. Another mission's been botched. Narrative point of view has been flipped again, and I'm no longer being seen. I'm being watched. Someday, may odd-mindedness pass as freely as left-handedness, once we likewise agree to stop persecuting and attempting to reprogram anybody born that way, which sadly for Southpaws was just a few decades ago. And no, I'd really rather not have to mention medication, but righting wrongs when you see them is a kind of obligation. And since I have a cousin who actually said, "But now you have no soul," when I mention the meds, there may be a need to show the face of one dense internal landscape supposedly selling real estate to corporate pharmacology, because folks still like to ask me, "Haven't you tried biofeedback, juice fasting, macrobiotics, rolfing, Reiki, goat massage, flaxseed colonics, hydrotherapy, hypnotherapy, past life regression, microdosing, tarot readings, tantric meditation?" Sure, most of those. So most days, I just don't mention medication.
We're listening to Rock Dove by Cat Kid with Soundscapes by Jackie Murda. This is Cat Kid's latest record, and we listened to the first six tracks of that record in order: Murmuration, Jackson Pollock, abyssal zone. Long snakes, Madonna of Montserrat, and Pigeon in the Gym. And you know, this is a record of 11 tracks about pigeons, odd-mindedness, and hope. That's how it's described on the record. It's told in four voices, three pigeons, so three pigeon voices, and one human voice. And just to give you some sense of who's speaking, there's Happy, the mystic. That's one of the pigeons. And Happy is speaking in the first, third, and fifth tracks. So we heard all of Happy's parts in what we just listened to. There's Beckett, the scientist, and that's track seven, which we haven't heard yet. There's Spooky, the veteran. So that's another pigeon. That's the third one. And then there's Lady, the human speaker, in this record. And you can find this record on Cat Kids Bandcamp site. We encourage you to check it out, and you can buy the digital album. It comes with a digital book to go with it, with the various lyrics. Catherine, you know, we've known Cat Kids work for a long time. What are your first responses to the new record?
Well, listening to it, I was really noticing, the music in the background and what it was doing. But then that's what actually gave me some insight into what the words themselves were doing, because, you know, Cat's poetry so often is sort of a very performative story, myth around a particular animal. And you know, in this case, it certainly is. Again, the pigeon features prominently, but really it made me think, like, the connections, the music connecting the different pieces made me think about this as almost more of a long poem than individual pieces. And I thought that was really exciting, because then, you know, thinking about this whole album as a long poem, kind of like a meditation upon one animal species, the pigeon, but, you know, through these different voices, it seemed like that was, you know, quite exciting. And also, then to think of like a long poem on an album, that just made me think again about, you know, how it's working as, in terms of its format. You know, we think about different tracks, but really when thinking about listening to it as a long poem, like, it changes how we listen to it.
Yeah, I think that idea of this as a long piece or a long poem in multiple voices is supported by how the tracks themselves are listed on the site. Because mm-hmm. You have the track numbers, you know, that are obligatory for, say, Bandcamp. But then they've also been given Roman numerals, the way you would see sort of in a long poem that is made up of different shorter parts versus poems, however you want to describe mm-hmm. the parts. I could imagine this being performed as well. I mean, I really, mm-hmm. like many of other Cat Kid works, you get a kind of inhabitation of the psyche of the animal that is being explored. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was talking earlier about sort of form and what Cat Kid, you know, does to poetic form. And, you know, so if I had to try to begin to define what forms do Catherine Kidd, you know, what work in, I think it's like a mixture of certainly poetry, also sort of rhyming children's poetry. So it makes me think of sort of Cat in the Hat. I'm not sure if, you know, a cat in part imagines herself with as having a kind of affiliation with the other cat, you know, the Cat in the Hat. As sort of children's theater, because it's often very theatrical. It's often very educational. Actually, as you're listening to these pieces, you're really learning mm-hmm. a lot about the animals that she is invoicing, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that would be sort of the beginning of sort of thinking about it, you know, along with obviously spoken word and, and theater of different kinds, you know. Yeah. So you can almost imagine the stage set. You can imagine a kind of stage performance of these pieces where the different characters, she's embodying the different characters as she performs them, you know, one pigeon addressing humans, you know, you could see that pigeon almost talking to the audience of humans about how you want to annihilate us. Why do you want to do that? You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. And also, you know, thinking about, on the one hand, I said, you know, it's kind of like a long poem of in the album, but really, like, from one track to the next, there was like almost this sense for each one kind of calls the attention of the audience. And it's like, okay, now, like, this one is caught our attention and is going to be transporting us into this particular scene. And I think while we were listening, we were both really imagining her almost like in front of an audience, whether it be a classroom, a stage, you know, a performance space. You know, we've seen her perform in so many different spaces, and no matter where she performs, she has this really magical ability to conjure. And I think we could hear that at the start of every track, that, you know, the speaker is really calling our attention and taking us both into the psyche, but also really into the story.
Yeah. And just a word about, you know, Catherine Kidd's voice.
Yeah.
So she has a really sort of lovely, deep voice, you know, as a standard, and a great singing voice, as we can hear as well. But she also does voices really well. And so I think as we continue to listen to a few more tracks from this record, we're going to hear a little bit of that ability to do voices, to inhabit characters. But hopefully, you know, our listening audience can also imagine what this might look like on the stage, because Cat Kid is really wonderful with movement. And, insofar as she's embodying animals with her voice, she also really does an amazing job of embodying them with her body, you know, and moving with them on stage. So try to imagine, you know, sort of the complete embodiment of the animal that we're listening to.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to listen to a couple more from this album, Rock Dove, and we're going to start off with Flying Rats.
You can begin to see why we're disappointed in you lot. Sure, we got along famously for centuries, been through wars together literally, but that's history. Too many of yous have too little clue how recently it threw us out with the trash. Garbage, chickens, flying rats, dirty birds, shithawks. Please, just call them out, we hate them all. That phrase, flying rats, can only be traced as far back as references in the New York Times in the 1960s. It was then popularized by a certain whiny, bespectacled movie director, squired Rosemary's Baby, then marries his stepdaughter. As pigeons, we're in no position to pass judgment on questions of cross-pollination. It's too difficult to monitor when there's 50 of yous living cramped under the eaves of one roof. But in matters of moral rectitude, it behooves you to consider whence they've issued. No offense to rats intended. So why not go ahead and admit it? You're a pigeon bigot. You know who you are. Who see nothing so disgusting as pigeon shit. Though how it can be so much worse than yours, we don't get, but sit with this. What today streaks moldings of banks and office facades, the bronze noggins of patriarchs, was once worth its weight in gold. Aside from being exemplary fertilizer, guano was essential to the alchemy of gunpowder. Great kings amassed its mounds of power. Yes, sir, the wake was regular as royal birdshit tender. We lived in lovely dovecotes, carved stone aviaries with arching doorways, misted with rose water by kindly attendants every day, as many seeds as we could eat. We could watch our young ones grow if you didn't eat those. But now we see them laid unsung in gutters after snow melts in spring. Matted gray, waterlogged pink little things with toe bones pointed skyward, where some urban vampire is flown off with their innards, or else they're squashed by bus tires and tossed to the curb. But don't worry, we've certainly seen a lot worse. Your notoriously short memory is a feature of epic evolutionary tragedy. A close second would be the odd fragility of your teeth. A beak isn't bone, but at least it doesn't rot out of your head, usually. Reminds me of a song we'd sing to keep spirits up during the wars. In days of old, when nights were lonely and cold, and royalist metaphors were still in vogue. It's time for reversing the order of things. We who've been underlings soon shall be kings. The first shall be last, and the last shall be first. At long last, the beaked shall inherit the earth. rock doves are we. Who even notices if there's two or three missing in action or singing way off key? We're just too many Hope is not for the faint of heart. In fact, it is a cluster of electromagnetic sensors in our beaks, which helps to direct our narrative trajectory no matter how likely we might get shot down. Hope can tear open a heart, but then helps it to mend. A strange force drawing us forward through infinite space, carrying coordinates back to headquarters, where hopefully hopeful loved ones await. Hope may become all for them in the end, returning home to them as safely as we can.
La 39e édition du Festival International Nuit d'Afrique, présenté par TD, vous invite au plus grand rendez-vous des musiques du monde, du 8 au 20 juillet. Pendant 13 jours, Montréal dansera et chantera au rythme d'Afrique, des Antilles et d'Amérique latine. Programmation et billetterie sur festivalnuitdafrique.com.
Hey y'all, it's the rapper Big Pooh, one half a little brother. And right now you're listening to CJLO 1690 AM.
That's right, it's CJLO 1690 AM. We've been listening to Cat Kid with Soundscapes by Jack Murda from her new album, Rock Dove.
And we're going to close out the show with an older track by Cat Kid. We started it off with an older one, Sea Peach, and we're going to close with another one that Jason and I kind of think of as a classic. So always at a Cat Kid show, you know, if she performs this, it's like a hit. It is a hit. It's called Hyena Sabina, and it is from her earlier album, which is also titled Hyena Sabina. And thanks for listening along with us this afternoon. Here's Hyena Sabina.
If I could be a hybrid species, here's what I would be. A creature who's one half hyena and one half me. And should I be called to testify upon my own behalf, I'd take the stand and be sworn in, then laugh and laugh and laugh. In the Kanuri language of the Bornu region of Western Africa, the word for hyena, Bultu, connotes one who is unsettled, does not remain in one state, an individual who vacillates between strength and weakness. Hyena are even able to shift between sexes, as well as from human to hyena form. The verb bultungen, signifying I transform myself into a hyena. There's said to be an entire town or two who can do it. A formidable ability considering hyena notoriety both proverbially as well as in popular mythology. The public image of hyena is generally not very pretty because neither, according to many, is the hyena with his tragic mouth and down-sloped eyes, ursine lumbering and slobbering like a zombie Saint Bernard, mournful looking as the mug of Goya's Kronos. But according to a proverb of the Hausa tribe, every fault is laid at the door of the hyena, though it does not steal a bale of cloth. The tongue of the hyena is barbed like the tongue of a cat. Some human beings are surprised by that,
because they suppose hyena more resemble dogs than cats, when in fact they are neither of those. Most closely related to meerkats and mongoose, hyena constitute their very own family. Hyenidae, order Carnivora, genus and species Crocuta crocuta, named after a mythical wolf dog with supernaturally powerful teeth and instantaneous digestion, which lure dogs and men to their doom, assuming a human voice and calling them by name, feigning the identity of a loved one in distress just beyond that clump of shrubbery. Not such a trustworthy namesake to be saddled with. A little like naming someone low-down snake in the grass or something like that, rather stacking the odds against social success. And so, yes, nobody loves a hyena. They're carrion eaters, grave robbers, shapeshifters, liars, and cheaters with a bad reputation for repugnant goose-tation. This in addition to being cowards and scavengers, demons and enemies of the church, overturning sepulchers and devouring the corpses of innocent converts. Furthermore, hyena are sexual perverts, known whores and hermaphrodites, chicks with dicks who can switch at will which sexy bits they wish to copulate with. They operate within the mythical dimension, with intentions that are shifty and shady, always changing from one thing to another, not entirely stable. You might almost feel sorry for the poor guys, but bear in mind the Mandi proverb, which reminds, it's never wise to show a hyena how well you can bite. Hyena, hyena, cattle of night, courser of witches with lanterns alight, burning hyena butter, anal glandular putty rubbed up against branches in two tones like tiger balm red and white, gathered by witches and gourds to light their course, then mounting hyena take flight onto the astral plane to do nuisance there. Courser of witches with lanterns alight, burning hyena butter, gathered in gourds to light their course. Here the hyena is bringer of light. With eyes open wide and a fine set of canines, hyena cubs come into the world via the so-called pseudo-penis of their mothers. In fact, an elongated clitoris of identical dimension to the male apparatus, making labor a particularly arduous process, but still downright impressive and not well understood why the females are packing in the hyena sisterhood. Then there's that laugh of hers, that maniacal cackle which screws with eustachian tubes, haunting the hearer ad nauseum like some kind of voodoo tinnitus. Now a crying baby, then suddenly a crazy lady, really makes you wonder what hyena finds so funny. Unless that laugh is a call to bear witness to some shift in emphasis from general culpability to a clearer analysis of how maybe you've been lied to by the same set of standards that has tried to define you. From symbol of depravity to source of light and clarity, what hyena best exemplify is that which can't be quantified, like natural science before Wallace and Darwin, a curiosity cabinet resisting easy definition. If I could be a hybrid species, here's what I'd be. A creature who's half hyena and half me. And when I'm called to testify upon my own behalf, I'll take the stand and be sworn in and laugh and laugh and laugh. Meanwhile, the profile emerges of hyena as scavenger, despite that they're equally talented hunters. Indeed, it may be lions do the lion's share of scavenging if we tally who steals whose kill most frequently. But lions have a better public image, shall we say. And so, as explained in a proverb of Swahili, the leavings of the lion are welcome to the hyena. So the truth is, hyena are just better eaters. Seriously, they're marvels of digestive efficiency. Hyena feces is as white as chalk and dry as rye vita. I seen it. You could probably draw a hopscotch on the sidewalk with that shit. Enzymes in their digestive tracts can extract blood from a stone, with tooth and jaw designed to grind bone, not a narrow lick of marrow left unscoured, nothing going to waste. Kind of brings back happy memories of your anarchist squatter days in East Vancouver in the late 80s. Scavenger was never a bad word, it was what you aspired to be. Diving into dumpsters in the parking lot behind Safeway, they could pretty well feed all 38 squatters and what the supermarket chucked out every day. And can it really be stealing if the lion's already abandoned it and walked away? And when Safeway started putting padlocks on the dumpsters, wasn't that pretty much sour grapes? So you went similarly out of your way to subsist on the waste of society because you didn't want to pay for what it pandered.
and in six abandoned houses the squatters took up residence, hooked up phone and power just like regular citizens, and petitioned the city to save those perfectly livable bungalows from demolition, instead of throwing up still more fancy condos for which not a soul in the whole neighborhood had the dough. The point wasn't solely to draw attention to the plight of the homeless, it was to avoid joining them. But when Great Aunt Enid saw squatters on the evening news, she refused to accept that any relation of hers could fall in with people like those long hairs, political radicals, unwed mothers. Couldn't they settle into proper jobs instead of cluttering up the steps of City Hall? Aunt Enid had worked as an office clerk her entire life and it never hurt her any. But you do have a job, you tell Great Aunt Enid, and this is aside from rescuing perfectly edible fruits and vegetables from landfills. You also work in the stainless steel, steamy industrial kitchen of a fancy hotel downtown, where they chucked out enough food every night to feed a crowd. Food which no employee was even allowed to salvage, at least not officially, which is why some rules are not meant to be paid attention to. And you arrange to be the one who takes out the trash at the end of the night. Dash to a phone booth and call up a certain United Church on the downtown east side. A neighborhood where homeless persons often line the curb like that ridge of dust at the edge of the pan which never gets swept up quite. And you wait in the back alley for the minister's black Mariah with headlights dimmed, and you deliver the food bins to him, carefully stacked in garbage bags of flat of mashed potatoes and carrots, a tray of Boston creams or whatever it happens to be, which breach of legality the good folks at the downtown church are only too happy to recycle into meals for local people, the broke, the addicted, and mentally ill, helping keep body and soul together another night. Because we might as well admit it, most folks don't love the homeless anymore than they'd love to see a family of hyena move in next door. They likely have lice or worse, homelessness may be contagious like some economic virus. Best not even look at a homeless person or find yourself suddenly flat on your ass and addicted to crack at the corner of poverty and despair, and then you die there. But hope springs eternal in darkened doorways and shrubberies. The more dire the fight for survival, the greater the necessity for levity, which must be why they call it making light. If I could be a hybrid species, here's what I'd be. A creature is half hyena and half me. And when I'm called to testify upon my own behalf, I'll take the stand and be sworn in and laugh and laugh and laugh.